Christiana Chamorro was getting ready for her wedding when she got the news.
I was in Miami trying my wedding dress, and my mother came and said, "Look, you have to come out because your father was killed."
A pickup truck had pulled in front of her father's car as he was driving to work. Two men got out of the truck carrying shotguns. They walked up to her father's car and shot him point blank in the head. He died on the way to the hospital.
I felt myself split in two.
Christiana and her mother flew back to Managua, the capital of Nicaragua, their home. And when she got back to the city, she saw something she didn't expect.
As soon as I arrived to Nicaragua, I saw the whole people marching through the streets.
Protests had erupted during his wake. Over the next few days, thousands of people took to the streets. Christiana's father's death was more than a personal tragedy. It would change the course of Nicaragua's history. His murder incited many Nicaraguans to join a revolution, one which in many ways is still unfolding today. From the Watson Institute at Brown University, this is Revolution Revisited. I'm your host, Dan Richards. The summer of 2019 marked the 40th anniversary of the Sandinista Revolution in Nicaragua. Last spring, the Watson Institute held a conference about the revolution and its legacy. And what was really amazing about this conference was that it wasn't just historians and academics. Many of the people who came had lived this revolution themselves. They weren't just analyzing the past either, because today, Nicaragua is in crisis again. The political party, now known as the Sandinistas, led by President Daniel Ortega, is back in power, but not in a way anyone would have imagined in 1979.
Daniel Ortega has become a murderous dictator.
Daniel Ortega, asesino! Te culpamos de la muerte de todos mis compañeros el día.
About 300 have been killed in violent clashes since protests began, including several police officers and many students.
Everyone at this conference was asking a question that has no easy answer. How does a country go from overthrowing a dictator in 1979 to living under a new one today? We asked the people who came to this conference to help us try and answer this question. And the result of those conversations is this special series from Trending Globally. It'll be in four parts, and we'll release it once a week over the next 4 weeks. We hope you like it. Nicaragua is a country of about 6 million people, smack in the middle of Central America. Physically, it's about the size of Ohio, but no offense to the Midwest, it's much prettier than Ohio. Jungles, volcanoes, pristine beaches. It's a beautiful, resource-rich country, but like many Latin American countries,
Nicaragua, throughout the 20th century, was either mired in civil war, occupied by a foreign power, namely the United States, or ruled by a dictatorship.
That's Mateo Harkin. He's a historian and an expert on the Sandinista Revolution. He's going to be one of our main guides for this story. And that dictatorship he's talking about was started in 1936 by a man named Anastasio Somoza. He was the first in what became the Somoza dynasty, which ran the country for over 40 years. By the 1960s, under his second son, Anastasio Somoza Debele, the government in Nicaragua was a full-on repressive military dictatorship.
Somoza's force is called the National Guard. The president is their commander-in-chief, his brother, their officer in charge, his son, the head of their training school.
This newest Somoza was known to keep political prisoners in his private mansion, in cages, with live tigers. Somoza was oppressive, violent, and obsessed with power. But where he really shined, in the pantheon of dictators, was his corruption.
Somoza understands very early on that if he implements modernizing economic policies favorable to the interests of the elite, they're not going to worry so much about who's president and who's in charge.
He knew that if he let Nicaragua's business elite thrive, his power wouldn't be seriously challenged. He sort of had a motto for Nicaragua's elite.
Make yourselves rich, but stay out of politics.
And mostly, they did. This wasn't the only thing the Somoza dynasty had going for it. It also had the support of its superpower to the north, the United States. The U.S. had actually been involved in Nicaraguan politics since the early 1900s. They occupied the country outright from 1909 to 1930, at which point they handed it over to the Somozas. The U.S. knew the Somoza dynasty was bad news. But like with many dictators around the world, as long as they didn't give the United States trouble, the U.S. sort of looked the other way.
Franklin Roosevelt supposedly made this famous comment about the founder of the dynasty that Somoza is a son of a bitch, but he's our son of a bitch.
That's Stephen Kinzer.
I'm a senior fellow at the Watson Institute for International and Public Affairs at Brown University. And during the 1980s, I was the New York Times bureau chief in Managua, Nicaragua. Later on, I wrote a book about that experience called Blood of Brothers, Life and War in Nicaragua.
He and Mateo were two of the organizers of the conference we had at Watson in the spring of 2019. As they describe it, with support from Nicaragua's business elite and from the United States, the Somoza dynasty went mostly unchallenged in the middle of the 20th century. Mostly. While the rich were maybe content with this situation, life for many Nicaraguans under Somoza was difficult and terrifying. For Gioconda Belli, this terror began when she was 10 years old. One day, she heard commotion in front of her neighbor's house in Managua. Members of Somoza's military, known as the National Guard, were looking for a boy who played on her street.
A squadron of the National Guard came to his house. They pulled him out, they shot him.
She never got an explanation, and she just had to keep going about her life like nothing had happened.
That is like a first memory I have of, you know, I would go to the store to buy candy or whatever, and I would pass by the house where this guy used to live, and the blood was splattered all over the wall.
Gioconda mostly avoided politics. But as a teenager in the 60s, she started to hear about a group of young people like her who were covertly building an opposition to Somoza. They even had a guerrilla army training in the countryside. But beyond that, she didn't know much about them, except their name.
Sandinistas.
The name refers to a hero of Nicaraguan history, a man named Augusto Sandino. Sandino was an early 20th century revolutionary who fought against U.S. intervention in Nicaragua. He was assassinated in 1934.
He's this sort of, at this point, a bipartisan nationalist hero and a very important figure in Latin America more broadly for symbolizing the righteous opposition to foreign interference. This figure, it's like, I don't know, it's like Lincoln.
The group was founded in Nicaragua in 1961. They were Marxists, inspired by Castro's takeover of Cuba. And they were mostly college students. A quick side note, in English, they also sometimes are referred to by their acronym in Spanish, the FSLN. We'll be using both Sandinista and FSLN throughout this series when talking about the group. They launched occasional guerrilla attacks in the Nicaraguan countryside, which often failed. Many early members were caught, tortured, and killed by Somoza's National Guard.
Nobody took them seriously. They operated in the political wilderness.
This is the group that would ultimately overthrow the Somoza dynasty. So how did they go from the political wilderness to the presidential palace? That is what we're going to look at next. As a teenager, the little that Gioconda knew about the Sandinistas, it honestly kind of frightened her.
I was afraid to get involved or be near them because they were supposed to be these subversive people.
That all changed in the late 60s, when Gioconda actually met a Sandinista. At that time, she was running in Managua's literary intellectual circles. She wrote copy at an ad agency by day and wrote poetry by night. And this scene she was in, it was a breeding ground for Sandinistas.
And that's how I got contacted by Camilo Ortega, the youngest brother of Daniel Ortega.
The Ortega brothers were some of the most important Sandinistas at this time. We'll be hearing more about them later on in the series.
We would go and watch, for example, Woodstock was the movie of the time. And he was very normal.
She became friends with Camilo. Her thinking on the Sandinistas and their mission started to change.
We began talking about, you know, the need that there was to be more active in trying to get Somoza ousted. And it made sense to me. I mean, it was very scary, but it made sense to me. And I began to read, I began to ask. My vision widened. So I admitted to myself that armed struggle was the only way to get rid of Somoza.
Gioconda, who had been scared of the Sandinistas growing up, became one. She kept her day job at the advertising agency, and she kept writing poetry, too. But in her free time, she started to collect weapons for the FSLN. Around the same time, Luis Carrion was learning about the Sandinistas as well.
I was studying here in the United States at that time, 1970-71.
Luis was from a well-off family in Nicaragua. He was a star student growing up. He actually won like a nationwide award for like best middle school student. His family sent him to a fancy prep school in the U.S. and then to college in New York. In many ways, Luis was an ideal candidate to join the FSLN. He was highly educated, interested in social justice, and hated Somoza.
My mother's brother-in-law, who used to be a member of the National Guard, Somoza's National Guard, who rebelled, was killed in 1954 by Somoza. He was tortured and killed.
Luis didn't learn about the Sandinistas through Managua's universities or intellectual circles, like Gioconda. He found them through their other recruiting pipeline, the Catholic Church, specifically through a strain of social justice activism within the church called liberation theology.
Theology of liberation was very popular within the church, the Catholic Church in Nicaragua. It preached, you know, social justice, liberation, and I started getting acquainted with those concepts.
Liberation theology is this current in Catholicism which advocated that, you know, the marginalized and oppressed masses have a right, backed by the scriptures, to rebel against the status quo.
In the 50s and 60s in Latin America, liberation theology sort of became a revolutionary force of its own.
It turns the Catholic Church into a gateway to Marxism for a lot of rich kids like Luis Carrion.
So I decided to leave everything behind and went back to the country and say, okay, I have to do something for my country. This dictatorship has to be thrown out. And so I went back and went to the university there and became active politically.
In 1972, Luis becomes a Sandinista organizer in Managua.
The FSLN was a really small organization in 1972. Very few people, really. So I was given responsibilities, important responsibilities from very early. I was put in charge with some other people of Managua, the capital city.
Between Nicaragua's universities, intellectual circles, and the liberal wing of the Catholic Church, the Sandinistas' ranks were slowly growing. But they would never grow enough to form a revolutionary front in the current status quo. Too many Nicaraguans were just too comfortable to risk joining an opposition.
Leon Trotsky has a quote, right? I think it's in The History of the Russian Revolution, where he says that these material conditions of poverty and social misery aren't enough to explain why or when there's a revolution, because if it were just about poverty and misery, then the masses would constantly be in revolt.
So what changed? Well, kind of everything. On December 23rd, 1972.
The Nicaragua earthquake hit the center of downtown Managua with awesome effect.
90% of the city has been utterly destroyed.
Nicaraguan officials in Miami today issued an urgent appeal for blood donors for the victims of Saturday's earthquake in Managua.
Its epicenter was just a few miles outside of Managua, and it flattened the capital and left over 300,000 people homeless. Foreign aid flooded into the country.
And the Somoza family brazenly pilfered it.
Just one example of this corruption. A National Guardsman who was friendly with Somoza bought a piece of land that he knew was going to be redeveloped with foreign aid money. He bought it for $71,000. A few months later, the government then bought the land from him for $3 million.
A lot of money and building supplies were rushed into the country to help the earthquake victims. However, much of that assistance made them victims in still another way.
There are Christmas lights on the citrus trees of the ranch of General Anastasio Somoza, the country's strongman, president, dynastic leader, and richest man. Somoza, whose personal wealth is estimated at $300 million, said he appreciated the international relief Nicaragua had received.
Corruption was hitting new levels at a time when a lot of the country's capital still didn't have electricity.
From the point of view of the economic elite, you know, they're thinking, that's not what we want, right? Like, this isn't actually the type of arrangement that is beneficial to our interest. It was violating this time-honored agreement. Make yourselves rich, but stay out of politics.
Somoza maybe didn't know it at the time, but the foundation for his support was starting to crack. At the same time, the Sandinistas do something that finally puts them on the map, both in Nicaragua and around the world.
And I remember just one day, December 1974, I'm 24 years old.
Alejandro Bendaña was born in Nicaragua, but went to the U.S. to study like Luis Carrion. And he was living in the U.S. when he realized that the Sandinistas weren't kidding around.
December 1974, there's a spectacular attack that takes place. A Sandinista guerrilla unit takes over.
A Sandinista rebel group breaks into a Christmas party filled with members of Somoza's inner circle.
Takes hostage a host of high government officials, and there's a ransom, and they get the money, and they get a plane to Cuba, but it was like world news.
The Sandinistas are friendly with Castro. They're sort of like Marxist protégés of his. And they're protected in Cuba. Basically, they get away with it.
And that sort of sparked all of us, sort of say, hey, wow, there are people fighting back. And after that, it was just a flow of 14, 15, 16-year-olds that say, where do I sign up?
Alejandro joins the Sandinistas in 1975, but he doesn't return to Nicaragua. He's already living in one of the most important fronts of the revolution.
My job was to look over the U.S. front.
Alejandro was tasked with convincing members of the U.S. government to stop supporting Somoza. If he could get that done, it would give the guerrilla fighters back in Nicaragua a real chance at overthrowing this regime. So he starts lobbying Congress, and he also basically starts a PR campaign. He writes op-eds, he goes on TV.
When you're a small organization, you're up against a dictatorship, then as now, the biggest ally you can have is public relations and public sentiment.
It starts to work.
Nobody likes Somoza. People say, all right, U.S. support for this guy's got to end.
Meanwhile, in the mountains of Nicaragua and Costa Rica, Sandinistas were laying the groundwork for a revolution. Gioconda, who by then was living underground in Costa Rica, did everything from writing propaganda to smuggling contraband across the border.
I would travel to find, you know, basically money to buy weapons. I would travel, bring, you know, passports hidden in a double layer of my suitcase. I also brought weapons to the border.
Luis Carrion lived in a safe house in Managua and covertly organized for the Sandinistas through the city's churches. The earthquake and the hostage taking had given the FSLN momentum, but they were waiting for the moment to strike. It came in 1978, but it wasn't the moment anyone expected.
I was in Miami trying my wedding dress, and my mother came and said, "Look, you have to come out because your father was killed."
That's Christiana, who we heard from at the beginning of the episode. Her father was Pedro Joaquin Chamorro Cardenal. He was assassinated by hitmen associated with the Somoza regime in January of 1978.
They simulated a car accident where he was driving, and so he had to stop the car. And then they shot him with a shotgun through the windshield. It wasn't made to look like an accident, nothing like that. It was an act of political terror.
I felt myself split in two. It was terrible, but I understood that his sacrifice was going to be for something else.
Chamorro was not a Sandinista, but his murder was a tipping point in this revolution for two main reasons. First, he was a famous journalist in Nicaragua, a voice of the people.
Pedro Joaquin Chamorro emerged during the 1950s as an anti-Somoza plotter. He became a writer and a journalist and editor of the most important newspaper in the country, La Prensa. And by the mid-1970s, La Prensa was giving Nicaraguans a steady diet of anti-Somoza diatribes and news and investigations and denunciations.
The other reason was that he wasn't a Sandinista. In fact, he was a member of one of the elite families of Nicaragua. So when he's killed, for maybe the first time in 40 years, the rich start to get nervous.
Because they said, wow, that's one of us. You know, it's one thing if you torture students, but you killed one of us, and that just proves that arrangement that we had, it's dead and it's never coming back.
Luis Carrion was in Managua when it happened.
We had taken over many churches asking for the freedom of political prisoners, and then everybody in the churches went out and come to the to where the La Prensa was. That was the wake, and thousands of people got there. They started setting a fire buildings that belonged to Somoza.
Alejandro was watching this all unfold from the U.S.
That was like night and day. That was an explosion.
People were on the streets, many of whom hadn't been part of a resistance before, and the Sandinistas were there to lead them.
You can have a core group of militants, you can have a group of even fightings, but unless you have people on the streets in a sustained way, well, regimes aren't going to be toppled. We knew that Somoza's day were now counted.
The time for massive armed struggle had come.
Riots and fighting break out in Nicaragua's biggest cities. Somoza-owned buildings are burned to the ground.
Nicaraguan President Anastasio Somoza admits that his opposition is better armed than he thought, and it will take much longer to defeat the Sandinistas than the 2 weeks he predicted.
The revolts, led by the Sandinistas, grow over the spring and summer.
The nation is now more united and more committed to rebellion than ever.
The rebels now control León, the second largest city, and parts of Managua itself, the capital.
The next winter, in 1979, international groups try and help organize an end to the violence, which had spread across the country. Somoza would have none of it. The fighting continued, but his base of support was shrinking. As it starts to look more and more like the Somoza regime might actually fall, the Sandinistas set up a sort of pre-government. It would be led by a five-person group known as the Junta for National Reconstruction. It was made up mostly of Sandinistas, but importantly, not all Sandinistas. They ask Violeta Chamorro, the wife of Pedro Joaquin Chamorro, to join them. She was a public figure and incredibly popular after her husband's assassination.
As soon as my father's died, she became like a symbol, claiming for justice and claiming for the same rights that my father was doing. The Sandinistas found that she had to be with them.
Violeta accepts a position in the junta. They also invite some other influential non-Sandinistas to join. Politically, the group is kind of diverse. And this is something that basically everyone, from historians to Sandinistas themselves, agree was crucial to their early success. That's because it's the middle of the Cold War. The U.S. was still freaked out about Castro's takeover of Cuba. And the political diversity of this group helps assuage some of these fears in the U.S.
That junta is the political expression of this broad revolutionary front, which, led by the Sandinistas, says that, you know, it's not going to be a Cuban revolution. It's going to be a new model of political pluralism, a mixed economy, and non-alignment international affairs. It was an extraordinary consensus around this program.
So instead of intervening, as the U.S. is wont to do, they actually gave some reconstruction aid. And most importantly, they gave the Sandinistas and the junta a chance. By July of 79, 18 months after Chamorro's assassination, the Sandinistas controlled all the major cities in the country. On July 17th, Somoza packed up as much cash as he could find and fled the country. Gioconda followed these final days of the revolution with her comrades in a safe house in Costa Rica. They got ready to go home.
We printed a newspaper in Costa Rica on the 18th. You know, we printed a newspaper that was called Patria Libre. So we printed 40,000 copies. From a friend, I got him to charter a plane so we could bring the paper to Nicaragua. And so we arrived at the airport. It was completely empty, the airport. And I came in, and I remember I didn't have a passport. And the girl who was, you know, keeping the place, I said, I don't have a passport. And she said, you don't need a passport. This is your country. And we all boarded the truck. We were all dressed in fatigues. We went into Managua distributing the newspaper. So we were like a squadron of newspaper boys and girls. People were coming out and they all wanted a newspaper, and we would scream, you know, Patria Libre, and they would scream, O morir, and it was the most amazing moment of my life.
Over 50,000 people had died between the earthquake of 72 and the revolution in 79. By the summer of 1979, Managua itself was in ruins. But the Sandinistas had won. For now. Next episode, how a country brought together so quickly is just as quickly torn apart. Revolution Revisited is brought to you by the Watson Institute for International and Public Affairs at Brown University. Our show is produced by me, Dan Richards, with production assistance from Alina Coleman. Our editor is Julia DeWitt. John Mazza's our executive producer. Music by the Blue Dot Sessions. Special thanks to Alex LaFerriere, Sarah Baldwin, Catherine Dunkelman, Steve Bloomfield, Matteo Harkin, Stephen Kinzer, and everyone who spoke with us for the show. For more information about the conference this podcast is based on, including photos, lectures, and a short film featuring many of the voices you've heard on this podcast, visit watson.brown.edu/Nicaragua. We'll be back next week with part 2 of Revolution Revisited. Thanks.